Good afternoon. We're going to call the Legislative Commission on Pension and Retirement to order. Thank you very much, members, and everybody in the audience for your patience. We're having a little technical difficulties, which you should be getting used to, but in this brand new facility, we all have a little issue, and poor Lisa, she had worked on it 2.5 hours yesterday. It was working properly, and apparently we can't seem to get that Skype going for Joseph Fox, who is the executive director of the Oklahoma Public Employees Retirement System. So we're going to switch up the agenda, members. After we do an approval of the January 12, 2018 meeting amendments, do I have a motion?
Madam.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And members, we also have a motion on your agenda for the LCPR 18-M1. And this requires a simple majority vote to approve. And what it is here's my notes. It's basically the, it comes from the executive directors of the plans on their valuation projections. And we have this requirement that they're asking to be suspended this year. It's also required for next year. And that
they want to move it to next year?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm going to have Ms. Lincheski explain it better. But basically, because of the bill last year and some of the work that we've already done, it seems a little redundant for the plans to go ahead and do this. We are doing a hearing on stress testing, actually, in the future here coming up, and we'll talk about that a little bit later towards the end. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Lincheski to explain this motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the motion has just been passed out, I believe, and it is a two-part motion. As Senator Rosen just explained, the standards for actuarial work requires that 30-year projections be done every other year. And for the three big plans, that is MSRS General, Parageneral, and TRA, they are required under the standards to do the 30-year projections and have them done as of July 1, 2017, and submit their reports to the commission by the end of January. Because of all the work that went into producing the bill last session, there were lots of projections done by the plans, and the thought is that having to do it again to meet this requirement is not very useful, and instead we would defer it till next year when we would have the plans do those 30-year projections, and we would then receive the report by this time next year. The second part of the motion indicates that when they do these projections, they should use a 7.5% assumed rate of return rather than what is currently in the statute. And this is to protect against what happened last session and the session before, where we were not able to get a pension bill enacted that would change those statutory assumptions. So instead of using what's in the statute for these projections, regardless of what happens this next session, we would have the plans run their 30-year projections using 7.5%. Which all of the actuaries are saying is a more reasonable rate of return than what is currently in the statute. I also, in the motion, included the actual language from the standard, so if anybody wants to read through that and see what is required, it's there in the motion. That's it.
Thank you, Ms. Lincheski. You explained that a heck of a lot better than I did. But members, are there any questions to this motion?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Sengem.
For our staff people, are you in agreement with this approach to delay? There's no need to do it this year, in your opinion?
Ms. Lincheski.
Yes, Senator Rosen, Madam Chair, that is our belief as well. We felt that the directors put forward a good case for why we should delay it a year, and we are in agreement with that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to move the motion if you needed that at this time.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. So moves. Senator Jasinski.
Madam Chair, just one question. Do we have an estimated cost of the savings of deferring it?
Ms. Lincheski.
Senator Jasinski, Madam Chair, I do not know what they have saved. I know that they pulled this off the agenda of the items that are being worked on by the actuary, so I suspect there will be some savings, but I don't know the amount.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Jasinski, would you like to have the plans get back to the commission on that
Sure,
question?
They can do that. Be great. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. With that, is acceptable. I would appreciate that from the plan managers. Any other further questions? Representative Driscoll moves that the valuation projection requirement, motion LCPR 18-M1, be approved for the motion to approval. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. With that, we are going to switch up the agenda a tad, since we're having some technical difficulties that are still being worked on. And we are going to have Mr. Kurt Winkleman, the senior fellow from the Heller Hurwitz Economics Institute from the University of Minnesota, come on up and go first before our Skype. Hopefully that works. And thank you very much, Mr. Winkleman, for coming and presenting in front of us. And members, before we get started, too, there is in your packets some questions that the Ms. Barth and Ms. Lincheski put together for our presenters. And so perhaps just take a look at the questions and maybe know the answer, but maybe we can ask our presenters too those. Welcome, Mr. Winkleman.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator Rosen. And let me start by thanking Senator Rosen and the commission for inviting us to speak with you this afternoon about a research initiative that we've undertaken in the Heller-Hurwitz Economics Institute on pension policy. And what my plan this afternoon is to talk a little bit about some of the components of that initiative and, well, basically give you some colors in terms of what we're doing with that initiative. I'm joined by my colleague, Jordan Pandolfo. Jordan is a graduate student in the economics department, and he's actually doing all the heavy lifting on the work, so I'm helping. In any event, so I know there's a handout here. I want to scoot to the page called Analyzing Pension Policy Trade-Offs. And the basic issue, and I'm going to come back to this first bullet point in a question mark form in a second, is that there's a pension funding challenge in Minnesota. I suppose it's good news. Minnesota has plenty of good company in funding challenges with public pension funds. Regardless of which state you go to, there's discussion about pension funding issues. It turns out that this kind of issue, figuring out, well, what, you know, how do you come to a different policy choice, is essentially what the Heller-Hurwitz Economics Institute was set up to do. So, if you will, it's right in the sweet spot of the things that we're supposed to do. And the specific goal of our project is to provide a solid research foundation for choices. So the last time actually we met and talked about this, Representative Albright suggested that we want to call balls and strikes, and that's basically where we are. We want to make sure that we have can take advantage of cutting-edge tools to help make help choices. But the ultimate choice is obviously in pension policy. That's all of you. The final point that I'll make on this slide, and again, this is kind of, a lot I'm going to tell you already know, it's kind of reaffirming, but there are sort of two problems that are being solved in pension policy. The first problem, obviously, is providing a secure retirement income for pension beneficiaries, but the second is reducing volatility of taxpayer expense. And ultimately, a pension policy has to satisfy both of those objectives. And at the end of the day, that's what our project is working on. I thought I'd spend a couple of seconds talking about the Heller-Hurwitz Economics Institute. I will not claim credit for the bridge metaphor. One of my colleagues on the advisory board came up with the bridge. I was trained as an economist, so by definition, I don't know about artwork, and I don't know about, like, marketing stuff, but my colleague does. Essentially, Heller-Hurwitz is set up to bring leading academic expertise and research to pressing public policy issues. That's the whole point. It was named Heller-Hurwitz in honor of the two founders of the economics department, modern economics department at the university. So Leo Hurwitz, a theoretician, and Walter Heller, who was very, very interested in public policy. And those two giants of the profession effectively set up the modern economics department, and hence we chose to honor it, or it was chosen to honor them by setting up this institute. It is very focused on taking research to public policy. We have specific program interests. One of them happens to be social safety nets. And within social safety nets, public well, pension policy generally, but public pensions more specifically, come to bear. So that's why it's Heller-Urwich. I thought I'd spend 2 seconds talking a little bit about my own background. I kind of come by this interest honestly. So first of all, it turns out I'm chair of the advisory board of the Heller-Urwich Economics Institute. Secondly, I'm a PhD alum of the economics program. Third, I spent the bulk of my professional career working in the investment management business and working specifically on investment issues as they relate to pension funds. Fourth, I've been board members, or been on the board of a large provincial fund in Canada. I've been an advisor to a large pension fund in the UK, and I've been an advisor to a central bank in Southeast Asia. So I've spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time working. So I'll leave it at that. I'll keep that editorial comment. So going back to the pension funding challenge issue, the next slide actually puts this in terms of a question mark. And the question mark is, so I went from an assertion to a question mark. I'll explain why in a second. But what I did here is I gave you 3 headlines on pensions in Minnesota. The first one that I know you're all well aware of was the Bloomberg headline from last summer that talked about what happened to the funding of the Minnesota Pension Fund by using the GASB discount rate versus the actual target rate of return. And the funding status went from the high 70s to the mid-50s, driven basically by the change in the discount rate assumption. There was a kind of a follow-on article, obviously, in the Star Tribune. And then there was, an article that took another point of view. So I've offered the headline on that as well. So the question is, you know, is there a challenge or not? I can come back to that. So I put it in the form of a question. I will say, though, that this pattern, well, I'll come back to the pattern in a second, but the pattern repeats itself in other states. You can go to almost any state in this circumstance, and there is the same kind of pattern. The next slide goes through what some of the effects are. Again, you know all of these, so I'm kind of stating the obvious. But obviously, when there's a funding issue, there's budget uncertainty, not just for pensions, but actually across all the other activities that the state is supporting. So that's a kind of an issue that pension funding really impinges on. That introduces what we call opportunity costs. So do you give the money to the pensions? You know, how do you make the trade-offs? And then there's a knock-on effect, which perhaps is people don't classically think about, but that is, well, what do the rating agencies think about the funding status, and what's that do to bond issuance? So I was at a conference on pensions in the fall, and there was a couple of presentations and discussion by the rating agencies on how they're thinking about pension funding issues. There's also discussion, frankly, in a presentation by a municipal bond manager. Again, thinking about, well, how do you think about pension funding issues in terms of the ratings and the value of specific municipal bonds? So the funding issue, there's a knock-on effect beyond just what happens with my kind of twin goals here that they're just important to think about when building a pension policy. Now, the next slide is getting back to the headlines. And I, with apologies to Bill Murray, I think many of us might remember the Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day, where he was kind of doomed to repeat the same day over and over and over again. And the thing is, there's an element of Groundhog Day when we think about pension funding discussions. And typically the pattern goes like this. Some article comes out and it says there's a funding problem. Then another article comes out and says, no, there's not a funding problem, everything's fine. Then the legislature, regardless of the state, says, well, okay, we'll give them some money and we're done. Repeat. So that's the Groundhog Day kind of experience that I think about when I think about public pensions. And it has been going on for a long time in this country, almost regardless of the state. So there is another way to do this.
Mr. Winkleman.
Yeah.
Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the witness would, how did Groundhog Day turn out? had a happy ending, right?
It did, and that's my next page. So if you think that's actually perfect, you reminded me that I actually wanted to use that. So the happy ending in Groundhog Day was that Bill Murray kind of had an epiphany of sorts. He said, you know, I need to completely rethink how I'm approaching life. And that actually is, I think, the opportunity that presents itself in terms of thinking about pension funding. And that is to say, look, rather than kind of saying we're gonna go from budget cycle to budget cycle to budget cycle, again, regardless of state, to say ask a different question. And the question would be, okay, what would a pension system look like that gave us secure retirement income for beneficiaries and at the same time minimized volatility for taxpayers? So the question is, well, how do we kind of square those things? And that, to me, is the very first question. It's like, where do you want the end goal to be? The second issue is a transition issue, which is how do you get from point where you are now to that kind of end point? And I know the next presenter is going to be talking about one specific experience in terms of a transition from one system to another. There are other states who have made transitions. So Rhode Island has made a transition, to give you one. Parts of the Pennsylvania system have made transitions. So there are other examples of transitioning between pension systems that are probably worth exploring. So let me do just kind of begin my stating the obvious stuff. What are the pillars of pension systems? So the thing is, it's kind of interesting, when you get into pensions, pretty much what happens very quickly is we get into the very arcane language. We get into the actual rate of return, GASB. We get into funding ratios. We get into a whole bunch of really interesting language that obscures what's a really simple problem at one level. And that is, we have to save some money, we have to invest it, and that has to support a retirement income. The thing is, it's not a la carte, that these three things go together. You can't basically say, I want a savings rate of 2%, an investment return of 20%, and a retirement income that replaces 100% of pre-retirement income. That the choice you make on the savings rate or the contribution rate actually has to interact with both what you want to do for retirement income, but also with what you want to do, which I was thinking about investment returns. And that is the actual challenge in terms of thinking about pension systems, is how do you actually square these things? It's not a defined benefit versus defined contribution choice. Those are actually mechanisms that are meant to help us solve that economic problem. So let me give you a couple of examples of pension systems and just talk a little about how they've approached it. And this is a kind of a quick overview. There's a report that comes out from Willis Towers Watson. Willis Towers Watson is a pension consulting firm and other things. And they issue something every year they call the Global Pension Survey. So I picked the two systems that are the best funded by their yardstick. Their yardstick is pension assets as a percent of GDP. They picked that actually so they could, I mean, I didn't talk with them, but I'm pretty sure they picked it so that they could make a comparison across countries. Countries have different regulatory setups, but we all kind of calculate GDP the same way, and you can figure out the market value of assets pretty quickly across different pension systems. So the two systems I picked were the Dutch system and the Australian system. And interesting, those are the two in terms of percentage of pension assets of GDP. The Dutch system is a DB system. They have about 168% of pension assets, about 168% of GDP. The two things that stand out about the Dutch system. The first thing is they use a market-based discount rate. So they use an interest rate to value pension liabilities or pension benefits that's driven by market interest rates. Their regulator is the Dutch Central Bank. They use something called the ultimate forward rate. That number is quite low right now. So if 6.1 was a horror movie, the ultimate forward rate, I won't tell you what it is. It's much lower. The second thing they do is they have a system in place that has automatic rebalancing or risk reduction as the pension assets get close to fully funded. So you can start with, say, a funding ratio, in our terms, of 150%. As you get down to something like 110%, then the pension fund actually has to take risk off the table. So there's a very clear regulatory direction about how they manage the assets relative to the funding obligations. The whole thing is up on the Dutch Central Bank website. So that's transparency in terms of valuation of liabilities. The second system I put here is the Australian system. And the Australian system is DC. So about 90%+ of pension assets in Australia are in some form of DC. The thing that's kind of a very interesting hallmark about the DC system in Australia is that when jobs are posted, in many cases they're explicit about the contribution, the pension contribution. So I've seen job listings for economists that give a salary of X and a contribution of 15% to 18% to pensions. It's kind of a guarantee. That's the contract between the employer and the employee. Again, very transparent in terms of this is what you get to invest. The money has to go into a superannuation trust. So it's like our DC system in that sense, as if it goes into a superannuation trust. I believe there are regulatory considerations on the costs that the superannuation trusts can charge. But again, transparency in terms of the savings rate, it's that first part of the equation, and in terms of the management.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Mr. Winkleman, I had a question. Are either of these systems, do they include employer contributions?
Mr. Winkleman.
So the way these systems are set up, and that's a great question on several fronts. So the way an economist would think about this, which is, just to frame it a little bit, is that there's a total level of contribution that's a percent of income. So it would be like, okay, it's like the employer is saying, okay, you're paid, X thousand dollars a year in salary. Your total compensation is X thousand dollars a year in salary, and then there's, 15% of X in pension contributions. So what an economist would look at is the total package. There's no necessarily distinction between employer-employee. And the number that we're focusing on our project is not so much employer-employee, which is not to minimize the importance of that. It's just to say, well, what's the total have to look like? The total, that's what we're kind of focusing on. Does that help? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you said that as the funding ratio drops, they also readjust the investment portfolio risk down, I would assume, because they feel they have less room for error.
Correct.
Now, naturally, people would tend to go the other way, right? I mean, if I see that I need more money, I take more risk to try to build it up quicker. That would kind of be the way most people would want to make it up, is let's take a little more risk. What you're saying, though, is that they have a policy, or that they've actually done the reverse of what intuition might be, to try to build it back up at one time, because you don't really have the risk tolerance that you do when you're in better times?
Mr. Winkleman?
So what they've done through that particular setup is they've said what they're trying to do effectively is solve an insurance problem. So they don't want the insurer to go bankrupt. And what they effectively said is, okay, as an insurer, you're capitalized at level X. So we're gonna use a very blunt instrument to make sure you're fully capitalized. And the blunt instrument is to say, okay, you're not as you get close to being undercapitalized, you have to reduce the risk level. Now, what you might do as an unconstrained investor, to your point, you might say, okay, I'm gonna take more risk. And that's right. Plenty of people have done that. But from their perspective as a regulator, they basically said you need to be fully capitalized.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Just one follow-up. So I'm wondering, is that a theory or a practice that might be fairly persistent throughout different European pensions or even in the United States, or is it something that, I mean, it seems to, from a financial standpoint, makes sense, but I'm just curious how predominant that rational line of thinking is.
Mr. Winkleman.
Yep. So what happens in Europe, so look, I'm full disclosure, I'm not 100%, I don't know the regulatory structures for all the European countries, but I can say that many of the pension regulations in Europe fall underneath the insurance regulations. So, for instance, in Germany, to give you one, the pension regulators are also the insurance regulators, and that means that they think about the capitalized value of the fund. There are other ways to accomplish the same goals, which is to say to make sure the pension system is capitalized. So to give you another example, again, European, and I'll give a U.S. one as well. So the European one is, if you look at the U.K., what they wound up doing was changing an accounting standard. They might have changed it again, but at one point they changed the accounting standard for corporates. And they said, okay, look, here's the deal. On your accounting statements, you get penalized. On your accounting statements, you get a positive effect for being overfunded and a negative for being underfunded. It's just that they made the ratios not one-to-one. So the penalty for being underfunded was four times the benefit from being overfunded. That provides a pretty strong accounting incentive to not be underfunded. To give you kind of an illustration in the U.S., and this is a corporate example. In the corporate, well, there's another thing, actually, back to the U.K. for a second. What they did in the U.K. as well is they went to a market interest rate to value pension benefits. So they moved away from using a target rate of return to using a market rate. Now, in the U.S., in the corporate side, in Pension Protection Act of 2006, which did a lot of interesting things, but one of the things they did is they went to using a market rate to discount liabilities, so double a corporate rate is the first thing. And the second thing is they actually increased the penalties on corporates for being underfunded. So if you go back 20 years, the plan sponsor had to have a longer period of time to get back to fully funded. And what PPA 2006 said is now you don't get a lot of time. You have to tell us right now how you're going to stump up the money to get back to fully funded. And by the way, the threshold is no longer 90%. It's a higher threshold. So there are other ways to kind of accomplish the same goal but the point is to have an incentive to do so. Does that help? Okay.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on Senator Pappas's point earlier about employee-employer contributions, and you were talking about how that works. In the United States, as everybody in this room knows, there's Social Security, which is kind of the front runner in a lot of different retirement planning vehicles. In the two countries that you've cited in here, do they have a equivalency of a Social Security plan that would also help supplement a retiree's income?
Mr. Winkleman?
Well, despite being trained as an economist, I'm not going to speculate on that one. I just don't know the answer.
Thank you. Mr. Winkleman.
Okay. So let me talk for a couple of seconds about what we're specifically doing. And the first slide I have here, it talks contractually about what we're doing in the project. And I say contractually because we received funding from a private foundation called the Laura and John Arnold Foundation to embark on this analysis. They funded a number of other initiatives on pensions, and we were fortunate enough to have them, to receive a grant from them to look at our proposal.
Mr. Winkleman, why did you choose Minnesota?
Why did I?
Why?
Mm-hmm. I did my undergraduate and graduate degree in Minnesota. I worked a couple of jobs here, and I've had my wife actually grew up close.
Okay. It's no particular reason on the pension plans for Minnesota. It's just more of a good place to start, basically.
Well, look, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I mean, if our objective as a as an institute is to influence public policy. And if we're an institute that's part of a land-grant university with the name Minnesota in it, then we probably should see if we can work on the Minnesota pension plan. It would kind of wouldn't make much sense if we said, well, we're really good at public policy. Let's go work on Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Well, it might make sense in January, but but not that.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so we have our contract. In terms of the contract, we are doing five things. We are delivering two academic conferences, so we want to get leading experts on pension-related themes from various universities to talk about their research. Our goal is to figure out, well, how do we use that? We are writing quarterly policy briefs that relate to pension issues. We've already published four. And those are up on the Institute's website. By the way, the policy briefs are written to be, they're not written for professional economists. They're written actually for non-economists. I'll just leave it at that. Then we have three policy forums. Those are open to the public. The Institute has had had policy forums on a number of subjects over the last 5 or 6 years, and we received funding for three of those. Everybody has a website, so we've got a dedicated website. But I think the most interesting thing from where I sit, actually, is the last, which is our ambition is to get enough material together so that we can help policymakers evaluate trade-offs for different for different choices in how to set things up. And it's not just policymakers, actually. My goal, frankly, would be to anyone who's got an interest in the pension system should figure out, well, how do we take this stuff and have better informed decisions. To give you a little bit of some of the topics we're looking on right now, they're a little bit more practical. We've been spending a lot of time looking at trade-offs between savings rate, investment returns, and retirement income, to try and understand, well, what's the minimum contribution? What's that translate to in terms of retirement income? How much of that is, what's the volatility in terms of wealth accumulation over time? Just to really try and understand, well, okay, what's this look like? What are the trade-offs? I know that your next presenter will be talking about target date funds. Target date funds have something called a glide path, which is an automatic change in the split between equities and fixed income. We're using some of the research on the previous bullet point to talk about, well, what do different glide paths actually mean? What are the implications? The thing about secure retirement that, unfortunately, you can't get around thinking about is, what do you do when you hit the retirement date? One of the vehicles that's out there right now as a choice is annuities. So one of the things that's an interesting question that we're looking at is, what's going on with annuity pricing? Because that dictates, that partly dictates actually the asset accumulation phase. The next thing that we are focusing on is connecting different choices on systems with the implications for budgets. And then the final thing that at least I'm actually quite interested in are some of the governance choices. How do you set up the rules of the road so that we can kind of avoid the Groundhog Day experience? Look, in classic presentation mode, I've told you what I was going to tell you. And I got a conclusions page. But basically, the bottom line is that our initiative is set up to try and take leading research on pension issues, and there's a lot of good stuff out there, and bring them to bear on practical policy choices. And I'm happy to take other questions. Winkleman. Oh, Jordan Pandolfo.
No, I don't have any at this time.
Nothing? Okay. Super. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Winkleman, or is it Professor Winkleman?
Mr. is fine.
Okay, thank you. Could be Dr. Winkleman. You know,
no,
you
Mr.
probably have a PhD.
Truly, Mr. is fine.
Yeah. I just had a question about that I kind of missed, and I apologize in your background, is if you've been involved in studying Minnesota pensions before this, or is this a kind of a new endeavor for you, and is really studying Minnesota pensions going to be kind of our history, going to be part of what you're doing?
So that's a really great question. So there's two parts of that. So no, I've not spent a lot of time studying the Minnesota system, to be honest. But the reality is you can't really start thinking about changes unless you spend a little bit of time thinking about, well, how you got from point A to point
right.
B. The reality is you get to a point,
mm-hmm.
there's decisions that were made across time to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting to think about, well, you know, how'd that happen?
Mm-hmm.
So that will be something I'll be spending time on.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, the other comment I wanted to make about your analogy to Groundhog Day and completing to continuously kind of repeating is another way to interpret that is with any system, you have to be, you know, pretty much continuously, stronger word than fine-tuning, is that it's, you know, I would argue that it's good that we are analyzing our pension system to see what the problems are with the pension fund directors to make adjustments so that if there is more volatility in the market, we make projections to say, well, now we actually need more employer contributions, more employee contributions. We need to take a look at the COLA. We need to take a look at, you know, what's the state's responsibility here for some of the pension funds and to be making adjustments. And if we just kind of did nothing, I think that we would see a lot more problems with our pension funds. But we've gone through, I've been around here for a long time, 20, 30 years, and we've gone through good years where our pension funds have been, you know, overfunded, and maybe we've gotten a little too lackadaisy during that time and not recognized that, well, in another 5, 6, 7 years, if the economy's not doing so well and the market's not doing so well,
sure.
we may have to reevaluate, so we better be careful. And for me personally, I never want to see our funds at 100% funded because I feel like then that is really does drive the desire to, you know, I'm sorry, to for more pension benefit improvements, which maybe not be affordable in the long term. So we're better off if we stay, you know, in the kind of the 80 to 90 range, then we're always being cautious with what we do. And I think we've gotten in trouble in the past when we've been, you know, too well funded. And I think that's fair, too, to current and future generations, that we, you know, we're not giving the current generations benefits that future generations are going to have to pay for.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Very well said. I think
Thank
it's
you.
Good to stay hungry. Mr. Winkleman.
So, okay, so let me speak to a general point rather than specifics, because you know the history of the state system obviously better than I do. But a general point I think is actually that you raised, which I agree with, is it's never good to be complacent. Regardless of the organization, be it sports, business, philanthropy, universities, it's always kind of good to look at what's going on both in during successful times and less successful times and kind of ask, well, is there a way to do better? So the idea of having a feedback mechanism in terms of thinking about, you know, what do we learn from both the good experiences and the bad experiences, to me, it's a what you call it, a healthy management practice. So I'll leave out the actually opining on a couple of things, on the level of the funding status and the specifics of the history. But I will say that it seems to me good governance has to account for setting up a systematic process for evaluating choices.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Winkleman, you raised the question of transparency in your presentation, but I'm wondering if you could be a little more specific. Are we doing something that you haven't noticed is not transparent? Our actuarial valuations are public, and all of our plan product is set out in statute. So are we missing something?
Yeah, look, I mean, I touched it at the very beginning, and so here I actually will venture an opinion, a more strong opinion. One of the benefits of some of the other pension systems that stands in contrast to states and to public funds is the mechanism used to price, to value future pension benefits. And what's happened in other systems is there's been a preference to use market interest rates as the mechanism used to value for reporting purposes, not for funding purposes, but for reporting purposes. So is Minnesota specifically doing something that's not transparent? The answer to that is no. Minnesota is very transparent under the rules of the road that have been existing so far. But my general comment would be public funds are starting to, and I think it's a good thing, to move to using more market-based mechanisms for the interest rates used to set the value for pension benefits.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Dr. Winkleman, when one tries to recognize market rates and then apply it to a long strategy for pension purposes, how does one establish a market rate, let's say, 12 years down the road?
Mr. Winkleman.
So 12 years is easy because you can use the Treasury curve and you can use the corporate bond curve. What the Dutch system has used in terms of, to that point actually, is they've developed, they've taken market interest rates which go out to 30 years and they've projected them out, they've projected that path out further. But there's a couple of points I want to get back to on this, actually. So one of the things about the Dutch system and the corporate system in the U.S. is that pretty much every participant uses the same rate. So there's not a lot of variability in terms of what interest rate you use to value the pension liabilities. It's the regulation. You have to use, for corporates, they have to use the AA corporate rate. For the Dutch funds, they have to use the ultimate forward rate. And there's not, that's just sort of it. There's been a little bit more leeway in terms of that one specific choice that I, again, speaking my own values here, I would recommend moving towards a more market-based rate. Now, to give you, again, a compare and contrast, the Dutch system uses an interest rate that comes off basically a government bond curve. And as we know, government bond yields are lower than corporate bond yields. The U.S. system, corporate system, uses the AA corporate rate. So they basically discounted future liabilities with a corporate interest rate, which is higher. So part of it is picking a market rate and then part of it is just applying it. So. Okay.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe you mentioned a couple states like Pennsylvania and I think it was Iowa.
Rhode Island.
Okay, and can you expand a little bit more about what those plans look like and how they made that transition to that type of plan?
Mr. Winkleman.
Both states, let me talk about probably the more important issue, in my opinion. Two most important issues are, first of all, they were faced with disaster. So it wasn't like we can wait. It's like you have to do something now. what happened in both states was that in Rhode Island's case in particular, the governor basically said, look, we're going to fix this. And she basically had public meetings. She talked, she and her associates talked with legislators, with union officials. And the guy who I already heard talk about this said, look, it's a math problem, which I actually don't agree with per se, because it affects people's lives. So it's not actually purely a math problem, but nonetheless, I kind of get the impulse. So that's what they did in Rhode Island. In Pennsylvania, my understanding is mechanically, the folks involved in that kind of reached out to all the affected parties to basically start the conversations. So mechanically, now what it ultimately wound up with, I believe in Rhode Island there's an element of D.C. to it, and Pennsylvania, I just can't remember.
Representative Peterson? Good. Okay. Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, just again, Mr. Winkleman, when you're doing your kind of background research, I really suggest that you talk to the director of the State Board of Investment, Mansco Perry.
Sure.
You know, he really advises us a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be just really curious to see, you know, kind of advantages, disadvantages, what are the consequences or unintended consequences of using what you're calling a market rate versus what we use, the interest rate assumption or the discount rate. And the average, how we've averaged, you know, 7.5% to 8.5% over the last, whatever, 20 or 30 years. And so if suddenly you start using a lower rate in your analysis, then I think you run the risk of kind of panicking about your pension fund and thinking that maybe you need to put more money into it or reduce benefits or take some kind of drastic actions, when the reality is, you know, you're still kind of on a trajectory toward full funding with
sure.
some adjustments. So especially if we're looking, we're dropping the interest rate assumption now to 7.5%
mm-hmm.
as soon as we can pass a bill. but to drop it to whatever you're talking about, market rate, 2%, 3%, I don't know, that seems pretty drastic. And I would really caution that we need to look very carefully about any kind of unintended consequences.
Well, I can tell you what the consequences are.
Mr. Winkleman, we're going to have to wrap it up here shortly.
Thank you. Let me just answer that.
Briefly.
Yeah,
thank you.
Briefly. So the consequences are, as you said, if you use a market interest rate, it will show a large deficit. And there's no way of getting around it. That's true. So that's true. But the thing is, going back to using the market rate, using the assumed rate of return, what I'd kind of plant as a question, and I will, I'm actually planning to meet with Mansco, is, you know, a lot of us, myself included, have been conditioned in terms of thinking about market, about equity market returns on our experience for the last 20 years or the last 30 years. It's not written any place that has to persist. So there's a risk that it could be lower. And if returns are actually lower, then that presents a whole different set of challenges. So I would just kind of proffer that as a cautionary note.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Winkleman.
Thank you very much again.
Your hearing, and thank you very much for coming. I appreciate this. Well, good news, members. We do have Skype is available, so give us about 30 seconds to get hooked up. And we have Mr. Joseph Fox, Executive Director from Oklahoma, who's going to talk about their path to a defined contribution plan for their public employees. And in the meantime, members, as we're as they're getting hooked up and making sure that we're online, for the February 6th meeting, and this can be adjusted, but we're going to talk about trends in public pension plan reform from Alex Brown, who's the research manager for NASRA, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. We're also going to get in person Robert Wiley, the executive director of South Dakota Retirement System, and he's going to talk about pension reforms to attract and retain younger employees. And then we'll get a report on trends and forecasts of our public employment in Minnesota from Susan Brower, our state demographer. And then we hopefully will be able to work on some of the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association plan updates from our state auditor, from the Fire State Aid Work Group, and the Paris Statewide Volunteer Firefighter Retirement Plan Advisory Board. And then we also have a hearing planned on February 19th, the day before session starts, that I'm very excited about this. This is Timothy Dawson, the Officer of State Policy, Public Sector Retirement Systems from the Pew Charitable Trust, who will be talking about ensuring sustainability of Minnesota's pension plans. And that is the issue that Representative Vogel brought up, and I think it's a great idea to start working on that. And then also we have to start looking at, for future meetings, the 2017 Omnibus Pension Bill updated to the 2016 session, and other retirement bills such as the PARA Admin Bill, other bills that were introduced in 2018, the LCPR Staff Statutes Cleanup Bill. So, members, we have a little bit more work, but I'm really very appreciative that you're here to listen to some of the other options, some of the ideas going forward, and keep working on this issue that's so very important to the state that we need to get done.
Can you
test any something? Thoughts, questions?
Testing. Can you hear me?
Ooh, we can hear you. Mr. Fox. Yes, Senator Limmer.
I don't want to interrupt.
Welcome, Mr. Fox. So glad to see you. I've been looking at your smiley Senator face for about a half an hour, but now we get to hear you. I'm Senator Rosen, and I chair the Pension Commission currently, and we have a very good attendance from both the House and the Senate, and a very full audience in front of you to listen. So you are live, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear before this commission. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. In fact, as long as it took us to get this hooked up, I probably could have hopped in my car and driven up there by now. But I'm here, and I'm here to kind of run through our experience in our legislature in enacting our defined contribution plan. And I don't know, there may be a little bit of delay, so if you have any questions, just kind of wave at me or stop, and I'll do my best to answer any questions you may have. And, of course, then when I'm done, I'll be happy to answer questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. And we have about 40 minutes for your presentation, and I'm sure there will be some questions, so I'll just interrupt you if that's okay to keep things succinct.
That
Thank
works
you.
For me, and I know you've already been in there for about an hour, so I'm going to run through this pretty quickly, and I won't stop on every bullet point, but maybe just try to get my points across. But we'll start on slide 2. What is Pathfinder? Well, that's the name of our new mandatory defined contribution plan, retirement savings plan. It actually replaced our legacy defined benefit plan for most new state employees that were hired after November 1st, 2015. That represents about 74% of our active membership that is no longer going to be in a defined benefit plan. And I will get to the reasons why there's still some left in our defined benefit plan and did not go to our DC plan in a few slides. But you turn to slide 3, and this shows you a little bit of our history of how we got where we are now. Obviously, we're all aware of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and then in 2010, the Pew Center report, the $1 trillion gap, unfunded state retirement systems, and the road to reform came out, and that caught the attention of a lot of our legislative members as well as pension executives across the country. Also in 2010, our state was going through a very large budget deficit. And we had many, many state employees who were laid off, who were subject to furloughs, or what we term as voluntary buyouts, which is a fancy way of saying the state encouraged people to retire early. And in 2010, our defined benefit plan was only 66% funded. Turning to slide four, there were multiple legislative studies on pension reform during this time from 2010 to 2015. And some of the reforms that did happen during that time period included raising the retirement age, increasing the vesting requirements, elimination of rounding of service, and expanding the final average salary from 3 years to 5 years. But all of those really don't move the needle too much in a large public pension plan. But what did move the needle was that last bullet point. The legislature eliminated COLAs from our assumptions from all our retirement plans in Oklahoma unless they were funded by the legislature. When that happened, our funding ratio went from 66% to 80%. On slide five, you can see some of the legislative studies that happened in 2010, looking at other states, what they had done or were planning to do. Obviously, the cash balance and hybrid plans. But our legislature really focused in on the defined contribution plan. They really didn't spend a lot of time looking at the other options. And in 2011 was the first legislative bill that was introduced. And I call it a surprise committee substitute because no one knew about it. No one knew it was coming. The first time anyone saw it was when it was introduced at the committee meeting. And it provided for a mandatory DC plan. It did not provide any mechanism for continuing funding the legacy DB plans. So the bill passed out of committee but immediately died on the House floor as a result of that issue. And then in 2013, an optional DC plan was introduced for all new state and local employees. That made it all the way through to the governor's desk, and the governor vetoed it because it still did not address the unfunded liability issue for the pension system, and it also did not provide a mechanism for paying for COLAs. And because it was optional DC plan, there was no certainty that a lot of people would even sign up for it. And I think there are a couple of states that have had those in the past, and they have not been real popular with state employees. Well, after that session, the legislature again studied the issue. And that's when the Pew Charitable Trust folks came down to Oklahoma and addressed a couple of Senate committees on the issue. And the Arnold Foundation started spending money in the state, pushing the D.C. idea. And in 2014 is when we got our mandatory D.C. plan. It was House Bill 2630, and it was a mandatory plan for all new hires beginning November 1st of 2015. And you can see on the slides there it had a contribution rate amount from 3 to 7% for both the employee and the employer. And, of course, the more politically active groups that are listed there got themselves exempted from it. The district attorneys and their employees are hazardous duty employees, which are our prison guards. And then a trailer bill, Senate Bill 2120, excluded all local employees. Those are our county employees and our municipal employees. So that's the group that makes up about 25 or 26% of the active membership that still remain active in our DB plan. And before the ink was dry on that bill, the very next session, legislative pension leaders decided that those contribution amounts were not going to be enough for state employees to save, so they changed the contribution amount to what it is today. They now have a minimum contribution amount on the employee side, 4.5%, and the employer will match that at 6%. Now, the employee can put in more than 4.5%, and if they put in 7% or more, the state will match that at 7%. And that's the provision that we have today. On slide seven, and I'll go through these next couple of slides quickly because this is more about how we actually went about in setting this plan up. The legislature actually gave us about a year and a half to get this plan up and running, and these are some of the decision making issues that we had to take before our Board of Trustees, and they were all very important options and ideas that our board wanted to consider. One of the bigger issues that we actually had built into the legislation, it was a key provision because it saved us a lot of time. We've had a voluntary deferred compensation plan in place for three or four decades, and we have a record keeper for that. So we were able to put in the legislation that we could use the same model for the new Pathfinder DC plan that we had been using for our voluntary plan, and that saved us a lot of time and a lot of money. And then one of the other big issues was, what do we do with employees that were in the defined benefit plan, left employment, but then maybe came back to work after the effective date of the new DC bill? And the decision was made that anybody who had any service credit in the existing legacy DB plan would stay in that plan, including if they left employment and then came back to employment after November 1st, 2015. Then on page 8 are just some more of the planning and strategy issues that we looked through, and we continued to meet with legislative leaders during this whole year and a half while we were getting this all during this planning stages and up and running. And then on slide 9, you will see actually how we built the DC plan, some of the essentials that went into it. We divided this amongst my staff. We had team projects. Some of them were very easy to do. Some of them took many, many months to do. Administrative rules, for example, that probably took 6 months just to draft those rules. And surprisingly, given the new plan, the name and identity was quite difficult because we had about 100 different suggestions on where to go with that, including from our own board. And then if you turn to slide 10, another very time-consuming part of this was getting IRS qualification. Now, we've used outside tax counsel to handle all our IRS matters, and we continue to do so in this case. We did receive qualification on the 401A side of the plan. We are still waiting over 2 years later to get our 457 private letter ruling, but we hope to have that sometime this year. And then if you turn to slide 11, while we are in the process of building this plan, we got sued by two members of our existing defined benefit plan. And they petitioned for declaratory or supplemental relief, challenging the validity of the bill and how it got passed. And you can see from the bullet points there that their main issue, they thought the bill was void because the legislature did not follow statutory procedures in enacting a retirement bill. We have an act in Oklahoma, it's called the Oklahoma Pension Legislation Actuarial Analysis Act. We lovingly refer to it as OBLA, but it requires any retirement bill that has an impact on the systems to be studied by an outside actuary. And that bill cannot be passed during that same legislative session. It has to be studied for a year, and then they can bring it back the next session and attempt to pass it. That did not happen in this case. The plaintiffs also tried to have the bill declared unconstitutional for retirement security rights violations under a couple of provisions under our Oklahoma Constitution. And then they tried to enjoin us from even enforcing the bill. In an unusual move by the district court judge, the judge allowed both parties to file a motion for summary judgment simultaneously. And as a result of that, the district court ruled in favor of the bill, saying that the issues were not ripe for judicial review, the actual soundness of the legacy DB plan was not threatened, and the bill actually provided for continuing funding for the DB plan, which it did. And then the judge addressed the OPLAW's issues and said that the OPLAW had not been violated. And if you turn to slide 13, you'll see that the plaintiffs did not like that decision. They appealed it to our Oklahoma Supreme Court on two issues, whether there was a violation of OPLAW And the court said, no, there are no issues here that are ripe for decision. And they based that on the fact that the court actually called Oklaw legislative procedures that just happen to be codified in our statutes. And our court has a history of not wanting to get involved in purely legislative procedural functions. So they punted on that issue. And they said the bill was a non-physical retirement bill, and it did not implicate any provisions of our Oklahoma Constitution. And on the second issue was whether existing funds from our DB plan were used to establish the new DC plan and for upfront administrative costs. Now, the legislature, when they passed the DC bill, did not provide us any funding. We are actually a non-appropriated agency, so we don't receive any direct funding from the legislature anyway. Did we use existing DB funds for startup costs? And the answer is yes, we did. But we do have a provision built into our rules that those funds will be paid back by the DC plan as we get money from the forfeited account balance. And we are in the process of still doing that. And so DB plan will get refunded all those funds that can be used for startup costs. And mainly those startup costs were the use of outside tax counsel and then our basic administrative formula for our staff's time and effort that go into each of our plans. Because we actually operate two defined benefit plans and now two defined contribution plans. All right, just real quick through the basics of how our new plan works. State employees have a mandatory contributions of 4.5%, and I'm on slide 16 if you're trying to keep up with me. The employer contribution match is 6%. Unless the employee wants to contribute 7% or more, then the state will match it only at 7%. They won't go above 7%. On slide 17, the employee mandatory contributions and all the employer matching funds go into a 401A plan. And any additional employee contributions go to the 457 plan. And the reason why we broke that up is so that if the employee wants to contribute as much as they can, they aren't going to be caught by the 401A limits. So they can contribute as much as they want and not have to worry about hitting any limits. On slide 18 is the vesting schedule. Obviously, the employee is going to be 100% vested in their contributions at all times. And then the schedule that you see there on slide 18, if they work a year, they get 20% and 40% on down the line. So once they get 5 years, they'll be 100% vested in this plan. And on slide 19, we consider vesting to be one complete year. So if an employee serves 2 years and 11 months, they are only going to be vested at 40%. They are not going to get the 60% unless they go over that 1 year time period. And if they terminate employment and are not fully vested, the unvested part goes into a forfeited account. And that's what we use to help pay and offset administrative expenses for this plan. On page 20, and this is the part that makes the whole thing work as far as the DC plan and keeping the DB plan alive. Right now, employers pay 16.5% contribution to the defined benefit plan for each employee that's in that plan. That same employer also pays 16.5% for new employees hired after November 1, 2015 if they go into the DC plan. They still pay the 16.5%. It's just that part of it, the either 6% match or the 7% match, goes to the DC plan. The balance of that amount goes to the legacy DB plan. And that's the only way the DB plan can stay properly funded. And then you'll see on page 21 a kind of a breakdown of either the 6% or the 7% match in the DC plan, with the remainder going to the OPRS legacy DB plan. On slide 22, just a quick couple of slides on our investments in the DC plan. Participants have investment discretion over all contributions, matching funds, and the gains and losses on those. We have a default investment option, which is a balanced fund. We have target date funds, and then we have actively managed and passively managed options for them to choose from. And you can see some of those options on slide 23. And these options are based very closely to the options that we make available on our voluntary deferred compensation plan. It's a good mix of options for our employees, and they have full discretion over those monies that are in those accounts, including the employer portion of that. On page 24, the impact and these numbers as of December 31 of this year, 2017, the new plan has $24 million in total assets with about 5,500 participants. That number of participants is quite a bit under what we were estimating when we started this plan. And it has nothing to do with the plan. It has to do with the fact that our state has no money, and there has not been a lot of new hiring going on in the state. So we were expecting probably twice as many participants at this point in the plan, but that's just not happening. The good news is, and this has really caught us by surprise because this is way above national averages from what I understand from looking at some studies, that 39% of our participants are paying more than the minimum 4.5%. And that's a big deal to us because I think we all know that 4.5% is probably not going to get you enough to retire based on a state employee salary. And I know that Oklahoma's state employee salaries are probably pretty low, maybe one of the lower in the nation. So our average state employee only makes about $32,000 to $35,000. So if we can get our participants to contribute more into those funds, it's much better for them. About 98% of our assets are going into our default fund, and that's because we wanted to get these people in this plan on day one when they're hired, but we did not want them to have to sit around with their HR person the first day on the job and try to figure out what investments to put their money into. So they're automatically enrolled in the balance fund, but they do have complete control over that, and they can change that at any time. And we are actually working on educational classes and information to help these people, help these employees make those decisions later on down the line so they don't always keep it in that fund, unless they want to, of course. And then on the fee side, our participants pay $2.61 per month to our record keeper, and the employers pay us 36 cents per participant per month. Now, I have to be careful how I say this because the DC plan was sold when it was being debated as it was going to be a huge cost savings to the state. In reality, it is not. In fact, it is with that 36 cent per participant per month, it is actually costing the state a little more money than it did prior to its enactment.
Mr. Fox, how much money does it cost the state?
I'm sorry?
How much money does it cost the state per year?
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Mr. Fox, how much money does it cost the state? We do have a little feedback. I'm sorry.
Oh, how much does it cost the state? Well, it's 36 cents per participant per month. So you times that times the number of people that are participants that are in there on a per monthly basis. I don't have that total figure. But it is more than what was originally thought. And then the last three slides are important slides because they are showing the impact that the new DC plan is having on our legacy DB plan. And on slide 25, our plan is a mature plan, and obviously with the mature DB plan, you're going to start paying out more money towards the end because your number of retirees keep increasing. And that's actually happening in our case. But unfortunately, because our plan is 75% closed, we now have fewer and fewer active members going into the plan. Now, a few slides previously, I showed you that there's still money being paid into the DB plan, the difference. The employers are still paying the same amount, the difference going into the DB plan. that's the only thing that's keeping our plan going, but it's still less money than we would have been receiving. And so you can see on slide 25, our cash requirements to pay benefits each month is going up and up and up on a pretty alarming rate. There was over 6% increase in FY15, an 11.5% increase in 16, and a 17% increase in 17. Now, but like I said, part of that's not unexpected. It's just the rate that it's going up caught us by surprise. And then on slide 26, you can see the blue line at the top is our active membership numbers. Right after the financial crisis, you can see a pretty big drop in number of state employees, and that was, again, due to budget situation. And then starting in 2015, when our new VC plan went into effect, you can see another drop. And obviously the bottom line, the red line, is the number of retirees that are going to continue to increase. And then the last slide is the future outlook. And you can see in 2017 that the blue and red bars, which represent retired versus active members, are very, very close. And I'm guessing sometime in 2018, our active membership, our DB plan, is actually going to drop below the number of retirees that we are paying. And I know I went through that very quickly. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fox. That was fascinating, actually. I'm sure we have many questions, and Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fox, can you hear me?
I can.
I just want to spend a couple of questions with regard to when you set the plan up. Obviously, on a DC, you have governance issues, much similar to a DB plan. But I'm just wondering how your group went about the governance issues in terms of who the fiduciaries are, if you established an investment policy statement. And I have a follow-on after you, you respond to that.
Mr. Fox.
Yes, thank you. Like I said, we had an existing record keeper in place from a long-standing voluntary DC plan, and they are the fiduciary under that plan, and we basically entered into a new contract with them to run this new plan. So they're very similarly administered and operated, and we do have statement of investment plans for all our programs. And our board went through that and voted on those investment policies. They picked the investment lineup, and it runs very, very similar to our longstanding voluntary DC plan.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fox, then when you're talking about the record keeper and the funds that you're using, and in an era where you want to be as transparent as possible, what are you doing to disclose or rectify with the record keeper and the fund class, you know, such things as the 12B1 fees, the sub-agent transfer fees? What share class are you using, and how is that being reported to the participants in the DC plan?
Mr. Fox.
Yeah, they're all very good questions. Those are all very transparent. Our participants have access to all those fees and amounts, and we disclose those in all our records. Now, they have access, full access to their accounts, and the fees are set out in those accounts. And they have our participants have full discretion over those monies. Our board is very cognizant about fees, and on our DB side and on our DC side, we're one of the lowest fee-paying pension plans in the country. I think we're probably not only in the top 1% in low fees, but maybe in the top 5 overall. Our board is very, very concerned about that, and they do not want any of our participants to have to pay any more fees than absolutely required. So we actually negotiate with these investment managers for that, and we've been very successful in doing that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Fox, just a final question in terms of you know, if you had to do it all over again, what was the one kind of glaring point that you didn't contemplate being as big of an issue, or what did you anticipate was going to be that turned out to be a minor situation to overcome?
Mr. Fox.
Very good question, and I'm smiling because we are now over 2 years into this, and one of the challenges that we have had, we are not in control of. Everything that we were in control of, we took care of and had it ready to go on November 1st, 2015. The parts that we don't have control of deal with our state payroll, and that is totally out of our control, and we continue to have some issues today with that. And if I were to do this over again, I probably would have started earlier in the process, having face-to-face meetings with our state IT folks that control the payroll system for the state of Oklahoma. We did not do that initially. We did get started in plenty of time, but we still have some unresolved issues that we're trying to work through.
Okay, good. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First a comment and then a question for Mr. Fox. A number of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, we had a study done on transition costs for the state of Minnesota to go from a DB to a DC. I think maybe we need to dust off that study and see if it would be useful. We have a lot of new members on the committee. Then I wanted to ask Mr. Fox, so you've frozen your COLAs and, you know, you've got less resources going into the DB plan. Well, before I get to that, we're basically talking about state employees that have been transitioned from DB to DC. Is that's correct, right,
Mr. Fox?
That is correct, but so, not all state employees. It's just new state employees that were hired after November 1st, 2015. The DB plan still remains open for those who are already in the DB plan at that date,
mm-hmm.
plus new hires that got themselves exempted from the DC plan.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then Mr. Fox, so my next question is escaping me, but it'll come back to me in a second. There are no direct state appropriations going into the legacy plan, the DB plan, but you're trying to prop it up by additional contributions from the employer, which is the state of Oklahoma, correct,
Mr. Fox?
That is correct. We
okay.
still are receiving contributions from employers, even on those employees that are new, that are in the DC
plan. In the DC plan, right. So, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, another question then. Is that going to be enough, or at some point you think you're going to run out of money? And do you have a projection as to when that might be?
Mr. Fox.
That's a very good question, and believe it or not, our funded ratio has actually increased. We are at 94.5% funded this uh-huh. year, but obviously a big part of that is the fact that the legislature has not granted COLA since 2008.
Oh, wow.
We all know that COLAs are very expensive, uh-huh. and that will have a large impact if a COLA is ever granted. We don't know when that'll happen. There's a lot of talk about that happening soon, mm-hmm. but that will have a large impact. As far as running out of money, we're actually receiving a slight surplus, and we have for the last couple of years. And our legislative leaders have kept that in place because we still have a small unfunded liability that we're trying to get paid off. Now, when we hit 100% funded, which is very possible without a couple of here in the next few years, those contribution percentages may change. And but right now, we don't think we're going to run out of money as long as the contribution streams continue.
And
Senator
you don't.
Pappas.
And you don't offer a COLA.
And Mr. Fox, you do not offer a COLA, correct?
Yeah, there is. Right now, there's talk about COLAs, but it's been a decade since our last COLA. We know that they're very expensive, and I'm not sure legislative leaders would probably grant the same type of COLA that used to be granted on a regular basis, which is basically a 2% COLA every year.
And Mr. Fox, how is the participation of the stakeholders and the labor organizations and all those that are being affected?
Very good question. When the bill was passed, first of all, we don't have a lot of labor union activity in the state of Oklahoma, but the affected groups, the other pension plans, our firefighters, our police, our law enforcement, and our teachers, and the state employee association were adamantly against the enactment of the PC plan. And it was about halfway through the legislative session when the state employee group entered into some type of agreement with the legislative leaders for a small pay increase for a few hundred of state employees. And at that point, they agreed to withdraw their opposition to the PC. And as a result of their withdrawal of the opposition to it, the other groups who did not have a stake in this particular bill, because it only applied to state employees, also withdrew their opposition. And at that point, the bill passed relatively easily. But I will say the other groups in the state are very much against going to the EC plan for their particular plans.
For their active? Or new hires, even? They're opposed to the new hire?
Yes.
Okay. Further questions? Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fox, you did a nice job of outlining the vesting schedule in the new DC plan. In the state of Minnesota, if an employee leaves public employment, they have an option of leaving their monies in the plan and drawing a proportional benefit at the time of retirement based on service and a few other things. Or they also have the option of taking their employee contribution and moving that to another investment, but the employer contribution to pensions would stay. Can you speak to how that would work on the defined benefits plan that you have for employees that would be severing employment from the state? Do they have to leave those funds there? Do they have the ability to take some part or all of those funds?
Mr. Fox.
And I'm talking about the DB side.
I was only able to hear part of that. I think the question dealt with the vesting schedule and what they can do with their funds if they leave state employment.
Mr. Fox, that question is directed to the DB portion, because you've done a nice job of outlining that in the DC part of the information that we have in front of us. What happens in your DB part at the separation of employment should an employee want to take those funds out of the DB plan when they sever public employment?
Mr. Fox.
Okay. On the DB side, if the employee is vested, we give them, and they leave state employment, they get the option of they can withdraw their money at that time, or they can keep it in our system, and then when they become eligible for a benefit, we will pay them a monthly benefit just like we would any other employee. But if they do withdraw their funds, they just get their contributions back. They do not get any portion of the employer contribution, and it is also without interest. And that's the same if they are not vested. The non-vested employee can also leave their funds here in case they do come back to work for the state. But if they want to withdraw them, they get their contributions back only.
Okay, super. Further questions? Yes, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to come back on page 24 to the participation rate that you were able to get at kind of higher contributions than 4.5%. Did you do anything? Well, I mean, can you explain how you were able to achieve that? So the 39% that are contributing above the minimum, I guess.
Mr. Fox, did you hear the question?
I did not hear all of it. I know it has to do with the 39%.
Yeah. Sorry about that. So the question, Madam Chair, is can you just give us any more detail, explain how you got a higher that high a participation rate of contributing more than the minimum contribution? Or haven't you analyzed that yet?
Mr. Fox.
Well, we'd like to think it's because we are educating our participants in that we've made it very clear that We don't think 4.5% is enough for them to save over the course of a career in order to retire on. Of course, that's the case with almost any plan nowadays, that you can't rely just on one particular savings account. I think you've got to really think about this and contribute to in multiple ways and save as much as you can. But we haven't studied it other than the fact that we do educate our employees and participants in this that you need to save as much as you can. And our communication groups go out and talk to state employees, and they really emphasize the savings option. You've got to look at our DC plan, even the people in our DB plan. You've got to look at other options and other ways to save your money.
Okay, Representative Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so I understand it, the 4.5% is, that's required. At least 4.5% has to go into it. That's not at the option of the employee.
Mr. Fox.
That is correct. That is the mandatory minimum amount, 4.5%. They have no choice but to pay that. They can go higher, and like I said, if they go 7% or higher, they'll get a 7% match from the state instead of the 6% match.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great. Which seems fairly unusual. Not a bad thing, but mm-hmm. Senator Pappas and I have been working on some legislation. Anyway, it's interesting to hear that. But I did want to talk about slide 25 a little bit. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is, you know, over the last, over the first really 10 years of my work here at the legislature, one of the bigger projects I worked on was moving a bunch of Minneapolis funds, which were closed funds, into our state funds, into our state pensions, and which seems to be kind of the situation you're facing here. And we got to a point in a lot of those funds, you know, any number of them, where just the number of retirees was so significant compared to the number of active employees that they became impossible to maintain anymore. And so I was wondering, do you have a particular... And looking at this slide, it looks like you're starting to face that kind of a circumstance. And I know that you're putting in that excess employer contribution. You know, here in Minnesota, we don't have anywhere near that kind of an employer contribution, so we wouldn't have those types of funds to fill in any gap there, right? You know, what we did with those closed funds from the Minneapolis funds is we came in with some state dollars to make up some of that difference. So I guess, do you have a long-term plan into how you're going to deal with this really becomes a death spiral for closed funds like this on the defined benefit side?
Mr. Fox.
Yeah, as far as a long-term plan, I think as long as we continue to receive adequate contributions, obviously we have our actuary each year go through and determine how much we need, and we know that's going to be changing in the coming years. But as long as we keep that contribution stream available, whatever it might be, we realize it may get decreased, especially if we get to 100% funded. You know, there's always going to be a need to grab whatever excess dollars may be out there to use for other purposes. But you do have to remember that over 25% of our legacy DB plan will remain open. Now, the question is, does that 25% continue to pay the full freight for all the retirees over the years? And I think the answer to that would probably be no, and that's where that extra income stream comes in handy. I think we are probably I'm decades away from having to deal with actual dollar issues as far as funding, but unfortunately a lot of folks look at these things very short term, and they don't think in terms of long term, but we are, and probably going to have to change our investment strategy at some point to become what they call more liquid in order to pay benefits. But as long as we continue to receive proper contributions and our earnings, 67 cents of every dollar comes from investment earnings that we pay out in benefits. And that's quite a significant number, and we hope that maintains for many years to come.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fox, you know, for the benefit of the DB plan, if you are, if you continue to be a participant in the DB plan, do you also have the opportunity to voluntarily participate in the DC plan?
Mr. Fox.
That is not correct. If you're in the DB plan, you're only in the DB plan. Now, we do have a voluntary DC plan that's been around, and that was put in place back in the 70s in order to supplement the DB plan. So people in our legacy DB plan do participate in our voluntary DC plan, but they do not participate, nor do they have the option to participate in the mandatory DC plan.
Representative Albright?
Mr. Fox, have you done any demographic slice and dice on who is participating at that higher, above 7% plus deferral for the people in the mandatory? Is it the younger participants or the older participants? Have you done anything at this juncture in terms of appreciating who is participating at the various levels?
Mr. Fox.
That's a very good question, and I think we do have those demographics. I don't have them in front of me, but if I'm guessing, it's probably the younger crowd.
Mr. Fox, would you be comfortable sharing that with us at some point, if you could dig that up and send it to Ms. Lencheski and Ms. Barth?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Good question. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know you have another thing on the agenda,
right,
so I don't want to take too much time. But Mr. Fox, I'm curious as to kind of what was the goal for making this massive change, excuse me, and has there ever been like a cost-benefit analysis to see if you reached your goal or if it was worth it to do this?
Mr. Fox.
The short answer to your question is no. I think how we got where we are was the changing face of public pensions in the country. As we all know, there's reform has been in the air for a decade now, and I think Oklahoma, to some extent, was I guess I could say it was one of the leaders in reform, because our legislature jumped out there and started making changes fairly quickly. And I think we are still the only state that has gone to a mandatory DC plan, a straight DC plan. I know there were a couple other states that have had something similar to that from long ago, but in recent years, I think we're still the only state that's done that. And as far as a cost-benefit analysis, I would have to answer no, that has not been done.
Okay. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your opinion, do you think it's limited the ability to find employees by switching from the defined benefit to the defined contribution?
Mr. Fox.
I don't know that it's limited the ability to get employees. I know that you know, we've actually hired a few new employees here at our agency, and they've had to go under the DC plan, and they have mentioned it, that they're not real happy about it, especially when they find out there were the benefits of a DB plan. As I mentioned earlier, the state's been under a hiring freeze for a number of years now. We are in a huge budget deficit situation, over $1 billion a year for the last 3 years, so there has not been a lot of hiring going on. But we do get comments back. I've actually been out to speak to some of our state agencies about our various plans, and when the newer employees find out what the benefits of the DB plan are versus what they're getting in the DC plan, I will have to honestly say that they are not real happy.
All right. No further questions. Okay. Mr. Fox, briefly, yes. Representative Thiessen, please.
This is just, I think, asking for more information, if we could get it from...
Absolutely.
Yes. First, I missed it. What's the funding ratio on the DB plan right now?
Mr. Fox.
94.5%.
And is that projected to... What are your actuaries projecting that to increase or decrease?
Mr. Fox.
Well, I don't know about future projections, but we've been in the 90s for several years now. Of course, after the COLA assumption was removed, that increased our funded ratio substantially, and then the market's been screaming for a number of years, and that's done nothing but help. So we've gone from 80% to 94.5% in, I guess, the last about 6 years. And I'm guessing it will continue, again, if all assumptions are met, we expect that will continue to increase because our unfunded liability is getting paid off at a pretty rapid pace. And that's even given the fact that our board dropped our assumed rate of return from 7.5%. They dropped it to 7.25% in 2016. They dropped it again to 7% in 2017. And our fund ratio actually increased during that time.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, if we could get kind of the actuarial projections into the future, I just am having trouble squaring slide 25, the slide on page 25, with that line going up at such a rapid increase. I guess one question I would have, how much is coming in from that 9.5% differential between the money you pay into the defined contribution plan, the 16.5% less whatever you're paying in the defined contribution plan, how much does that generate each year?
Mr. Fox.
I don't have that number in front of me. I could easily get that number. But that money still coming in is really making a difference. And again, of course, you know, with the investments at very high levels, that's making a very big difference in the amount of our assets and our net worth, basically. Obviously, if any of those assumptions change, if we do not earn our 7%, or if the demographics change, part of it I might mention here is that our actuary changed one of our salary assumptions because they had built in, I think, about a 4.5% salary increase as part of our assumption base. They changed that this year because salaries are not increasing. They actually lowered that percentage, and that made a difference as well. So there's, as you know, if you study the actuarial side of these things, there's a lot of things that go into it, a lot of different numbers that can easily change one way or the other and can obviously make your funded ratio rise or dip either way.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the two things that I would just ask is if there is the possibility of getting kind of projections into the future that your actuaries have done, extending the chart on page 25 into the future, what they would project those numbers would be, and then how that relates to the amount of money that's coming in from the basically the arbitrage between your 16.5% and what you're paying out to the DC plan, that would be really helpful.
Mr. Fox?
Yeah, we can provide any information that you may need. If you want Susan just to send me an update of the questions, and I'll be happy to get back with her on that.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Fox. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Good questions. And thank you, everybody, for your engagement on this. Mr. Fox, thank you very much. I really appreciate your patience, and very nice talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me, and like I said, I'll be happy to share any information that you may need.
Good. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, members, we have got Mr. Joel Michael, our House Research, and Ms. Nora Pollack, our Senate Counsel, for the brief summary on what the federal tax bill is going to do on our pension plans. Mr. Michael, I think you're up first. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Norton and I will divide this up. It's going to be a short story, fortunately. I think the legislature in the next session will have a long conversation about how to respond to the Federal Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But I think on the pension side, that's basically a non-issue. So the way we'll divide this up is I'll spend a little time talking about just the handful of provisions that are actually in the federal legislation that directly relate to retirement and pension provisions, and then Nora will describe the impact of the federal changes more generally on the typical or average recipient of pension distributions. Yeah, if you have questions, we'll definitely respond as we can to those to your questions. So the Tax Cut and Jobs Act made three changes to retirement and pension plan operations or distributions. Some of those relate directly to public pension plans. One of them does not. So the first of these is that many of you probably are familiar with Roth IRA conversions. You're allowed, if you have IRA assets, to convert them to Roth assets and pay the tax on the amount that you convert. There's been a rule that under an IRS regulation that essentially allows you to reverse those conversions. What the tax bill does is it repeals the authority to essentially do over or reverse that contribution. The most typical reason why people would do that is they made a conversion early in the tax year, and what happened is their account went down in value, so they, because the IRS rule allows you to reconvert, it just makes sense to say, why should I pay tax on an investment that's gone down? The tax bill takes away that authority. It does not take away that authority for a contribution to a Roth that you made during the year, so you still have the authority. And sometimes taxpayers will discover that their income is higher than the Roth limit, and so for that reason they'll want to essentially recharacterize their contribution. That still will be permitted. The federal estimate that that'll raise about $500 million over 10 years. Revenue has translated that to Minnesota, and the handout shows what revenue is estimating that effect is on Minnesota if we conform, and that's $450,000 in the current biennium and $600,000 in the next biennium. The second explicit provision, it has exactly the opposite federal revenue effect of $500 million, so those two provisions in combination offset each other and make the federal bill revenue neutral. And this provision relates to the amount that can be set aside for length of service awards for volunteer firefighters and EMTs and so forth. In current law, that's a $3,000 limit. What the federal tax bill does is increases that limit to $6,000 and indexes it for inflation in the future. And this amount is the amount that is at the front end. From talking with the staff for the commission, I understand the way the Minnesota formulas work, those formulas are sort of back-end formulas and say that after you have X number of years of service, you get a dollar amount times that. So these front-end amounts are subject to an actuarial adjustment in that formula. The final provision, and I will say on the Minnesota cost of this, there's no cost because if you look at the flows on the federal, all of the cost is outside of our budget window, so revenue has not assigned a cost to this, unlike the feds that look at a 10-year time period, whereas we only look at four. The third explicit change is that there's a change in what are often referred to as loan offsets or rollovers. This does affect, mainly people think about 401k loans, but in theory, you can have these from 403b plans or 457 plans. I don't personally know if Minnesota's 457 plan allows loans. I don't think it does, and I'm getting the confirmation on that from the staff. So, but anyway, the situation is this. You've taken out a loan against your 401k plan, and then you terminate your employment. Under current law, that's treated as a plan distribution. And so if you're under age 59 and a half, you'll not only have to include that in your income, but you would pay a 10% early withdrawal additional tax on that. You have the authority under current law, and this is what I'll describe the change. You have 60 days to put the money back into the plan to avoid having the fact that you left employment treated as a distribution of the loan. What the new federal law does is it gives you more time to replace that money, to put the money back and avoid having the loan be treated as essentially a distribution. You have until the due date of your return for that tax year. So let's say you quit in July. You know, the tax year, typically almost everybody's a calendar year taxpayer, and your return is due the next year. So rather than just having 60 days, you in that case would probably have something more like, you know, 9 months or something to replace. So there's more time to avoid the deemed distribution. So those are the only three explicit provisions that relate to retirement and pensions. Now, I suspect those of you who were following the process like a lot of us were as it was quickly going through, there were a handful of other provisions that were either in the House bill or the Senate bill that got dropped by conference. Some of those would have more direct effect on public pensions. For example, 457 plans do not have an early 10% early withdrawal. One of the House bill proposed to subject 457 plans to the same rules that apply to 401ks. They dropped that. There are a few other provisions. I know the staff mentioned to me interest about a UBIT provision that would have potentially subjected public pension plans to UBIT on if they have the kinds of investments that would trigger UBIT. And basically, UBIT refers to the unrelated business income tax. You know, tax-exempt entities, if they have those kinds of investments, so if they have an investment in a business, for example, that's not related to their mission, they may end up paying a tax on that just like as if they were a taxable corporation. Again, this provision was dropped in conference, so it's irrelevant and it probably isn't worth talking too much about. But had it passed, it may have affected some of the alternative investments that SBI has. I don't know. You know, a typical no-no for a regular person, if you have an IRA and you go out and buy a master limited partnership and put it in your IRA, that's a no-no because it will trigger UBIT. And this is the sort of the same kind of philosophy with regard to public pensions. But Congress, in its wisdom, dropped that provision in conference. And, in fact, there was one other provision that was identical in both bills, and like those of us involved in the tax legislative process in Minnesota know, surprisingly, that didn't make it through, I'm sure, because they needed to meet a revenue target. With that, I'll turn it over to Norris to talk about the effect on the typical pension recipient.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. And before we have Ms. Pollack speak, members, there's a really great summary here put out by Mr. Michael and Ms. Pollack in your folder. And we do have the Senate tax chair, Senator Chamberlain, in the back, and he's more than welcome to come up and if there's any questions. But are there any questions for Mr. Michael? No? Thank you. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, I'll just make a couple of brief comments on some major issues that were addressed in the Tax Cuts Act. But generally, overall, these changes don't have any effect differently to pension recipients than they do to wage earners. So if you turn to the back of the second side of the handout, some of the major provisions were to increase the standard deduction, doubling it essentially for individuals and then also for married couples, eliminating the personal exemptions, limiting the state and local deductions for itemizers to $10,000, repealing various itemized deductions, and repealing the income phase out for itemized deductions. We received a list of questions from someone. And I think to respond to the first question, which is, could you explain how the state of Minnesota taxes retirees on pension payments they receive from our public pension plans? They don't tax pension retirees any differently than any other wage earners. So as I mentioned before, these plans, the changes in the Tax Cuts Act have no greater effect generally to pension recipients than to other wage earners in the state. I think unless you have any other questions, we can go on to the other questions from your list to the extent that we can respond to them.
Ms. Pollack, I don't think there's questions, so okay. Please proceed.
So the second question is, please explain what impact, if any, the change to the length of service awards will have on our volunteer firefighters who receive lump sum pension benefits based on length of service. Joel and I chatted a little bit about this earlier. It's not clear. If the lump sum includes a length of service award, it's not clear whether that renders the length of service award subject to tax. Generally, it's not included in the income calculation. It's not clear, I think, how the lump sum distributions that are in question would be bundled together if the length of service award is part of that distribution. If we can get some more information on how those are distributed, we can certainly advise further on how they would be tax treated.
Further questions?
And I think you
are. Thank you, Ms. Pollack.
Already. Yeah.
Proceed.
And Madam Chair, I think the third question was on the UBIT provision that was excluded, and I think Mr. Michael addressed that.
Okay. Questions? All right. Well, thank you. That was brief, confusing, and I'm sure we'll have more questions, and Senator Chamberlain's right across the hall, so I'll take a walk over there. But if there is no further questions, I appreciate you coming all the way over. Thank you very much. You too. So, members, that is the conclusion of our pension hearing. And, again, February 6th at 2 o'clock is our next hearing, and we are going to be delving into, again, South Dakota, NASRA, our state demographer, and the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association pension issues. Any comments, questions? With that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.